Okay, good morning, everybody. So let me take the opportunity to stand here and really thank the organizers of this wonderful program. So I think having the feeling to be at the same time on holidays and still work a lot, that's exactly the right combination. So thank you very much. I'm really enjoying being here. So then I think, after this break from neckties that Ivo provided us with, we are ready to get back to neckties. But we will do so actually in a modest way. So I will not talk about superconductivity at all. I will not even talk about magnetism. I will stick to the boring, let's say, high temperature phase in the easiest structure. But there I will ask, let's say, more ambitious questions in the sense that I want to aim at a quantitative description. So let me give you just Okay, sorry, that was actually the wrong presentation. So let me give you the example for this workshop. So you all know the little brother of the first lanthanum 1111, the phosphor compound here, for which there was this photo emission data out, the color plot. And then there was the band structure, and the authors were stating that you have good agreement between photo emission and band structure because essentially you get roughly the features at the right spots.
But you should, scale, right?
You should always read the small print after shifting the calculated bands up by 0.1 and renormalizing by factor 2.2. So the question I'm going to ask here, this kind of calculation, is that state of the art? Do we have to do a calculation and then rescale and shift as we want? Or can we do better and directly address these shifts, these rescalings from first principles, that means from theories without adjustable parameters? Okay, so that means the program is here. We want to develop methods where we can describe materials with strong Coulomb correlations. That means we want to go beyond just the single particle band picture. But we want to do so not only for a ground state, but in particular for excited state, so for the photo emission spectrum, for example. We want to do so at higher temperatures, and we want to avoid adjustable parameters. So we want in our theory essentially only the constant of nature. Okay, the strategy that we use here is to combine many body techniques with electronic structure. And so that leads me to my outline. I will start by telling you briefly what is this combined density function theory plus dynamic and mean field method. Flash a very quick example, one slide on Syria. This is a relaxation break from the neckties. Then I will show you more neckties examples. A funny application to binding 1 to 2, where this description leads to a prediction of a strong doping dependence of covariance properties. And then I will switch back to the more methodological parts and tell you that still we have a lot of work to do even on the method part. I will talk about U, about cover U. And then tell you more recent attempts to improve the entire interface of dynamic and mean field theory to electronic structure conditions. And so the disclaimer, since I really want to focus on these method developing parts eventually, I will not give you a full review of everything that exists within DFT plus DMFT. So there's a whole flurry of papers out there from various groups here, for example, the ones cited here. I will not give you a thorough review of the literature, but focus on the stuff that leads me then to my further developments. Okay, as I said, I want to develop techniques where we combine ab initio techniques with many-body theory. And for many-body theory, I will use my favorite here, namely dynamic and mean field theory, which was originally developed in the model context where you met. That is more of correlated fermions on a single-side model coupled to a self-consistent bath. And that theory was known to give you a description, let's say, of the mod transition here in the paramagnetic half-field Hubbard model, the simplest drosophila case, where you go from the spectral function of an uncorrelated metal to a renormalized quasi-particle Hubbard dance developing in the correlated metal state up to the mod insulator, where you open a gap here. Okay, so that was the model state 20 years ago. Now we want to be realistic. So we don't want to map a Hubbard model onto a single side. We want to do that for the solid, you're varying 1 to 2, for example. And the strategy is the same. You map the solid on an effective atom, which still has the interactions, and which is coupled to a bath that has to be determined self-consistently. Okay, so what does it mean, Kabul and Adam? Well, it means we need to put in realistic parameters somewhere. And those we get in this first approach here that I described from density function theory. So now it's very appropriate to show this figure here, even though we have the original not too far. Density function theory provides you a mapping of an interacting electron gas on a non-interacting effector system with the same ground state density.
Sorry to interrupt. So, tell you to wear a microphone.
Yeah. Oh. Oh,
cool.
Thank you. Your entire discussion has been recorded.
Okay, so we will use density function theory, not in this original sense here, namely to calculate ground state properties, but we will use it as a means to generate the parameters of the one body parabola Hamiltonian. So that means in practice, we will use it to construct a kind of multi-orbital, at least in the simplest version of the SP plus NFT, a kind of multi-orbital Hubbard model where the one-body part of the Hamiltonian is given by the matrix elements of the Conchamp Hamiltonian expressed in a localized basis set. And then this is supplemented for the correlated orbitals, so for example, the 3D states in the necktides, by explicit Hubbard interactions or Hubbard and Hund. If you have a multi-orbital case, you can have a reduction of the Hubbard interaction if you have parallel spins in different orbits. And this kind of Hamiltonian is then solved within this dynamical linkage.
And what is H double counting?
Yes. Okay, you asked this question early. Usually I answer it later on. So since in the DFT part, we have already, in principle, all the interactions included, DFT was meant to give you a description of the full interacting Hamiltonian. We have to be careful not to double count things. So we have to make a subtraction from the LDA part, which is supposed to subtract that part which is afterwards explicitly treated. However, as you have in mind, that is of course the kind of weak point in the theory, because there is no mathematical formulation of that thing, so you can only find the physically motivated arguments of what you subtract. And that's one of the motivations why also we want to go further. We want to get rid of the LDA, because as long as you stay in the DFT context, you're bound to have that term in a kind of not mathematically defined fashion. Okay, so the modern implementations look a little bit more fancy, and let's get that. You don't have to express things explicitly in the correlated basis set. You can go back and forth within your DFT implementation within different basis sets. But let me skip the technical parts. Let me give you a flavor, and this is the one slide commercial on the non-nick type, what the NFT does. And I do that on this kind of cerium compound, actually cerium fluorosulfide, this cerium sulfide compound, which is used as a pigment to color your smart. Okay, so now this is a F1 compound, which tells you already that any band theory will give you a nice metal for that. And of course, that's plain wrong, because being red means having a gap of 2.1 eV. So the reason is, of course, that the F states here do not form bands. They just stay atomic-like, they stay localized. And to get a quantitative description of that thing, what you need to do is to describe the coexistence of localized F states with surrounding P and D states, which are band-forming states. And that is precisely what NFT is doing for you here. So here it's plotted the spectral function as a function of k. Well, that's not a band structure, it's really the spectral function, k resolve, for the f only and for the total spectral function. And you see you open up a gap at the further level. And you do so because the f's are actually split in multiplets. So you're looking at the atomic spectroscopy concerning the f states coexisting with band forming states from cerium D states, from the fluorine and sulfur D states.
What is the valence of the F?
I'm sorry?
What is the valence of the F
electron? F1.
So these are localized moments?
Localized, yes. But the thing is not, there's no magnetic order found. Mm-hmm. So this is a paramagnetic calculation which opens up the gap. Of course, if you assume magnetic order, you can gradually cast through, split things, and do other things. But in the paramagnetic phase, there's no way around that then going away from band theory. And that's what essentially.
So how does the band structure sink the F states beneath the Fermi energy without having it?
Well, it's a kind of Hubbard band here, right? So this is the filled Hubbard band, and here's the, and this is split now in the multiplet structure.
And so it's a, so no Kondo effect.
No Kondo, no. Just plain localized limit. Okay.
And why doesn't it order magnetically?
Okay. Mm. No, the structure effect is quite simple.
Please, I mean,
compounds
do order.
Yes, but I could still show another example. For example, cerium 203, you get order, but you get it at about 10 Kelvin, and you have a gap of several dB, which tells you that there's a mismatch of energy scales. If you need the magnetism, which is gone at 11 Kelvin, to open the gap, then you still prefer a method which opens the gap.
In your calculations, a paramagnetic state lower in energy than anti-paramagnetic?
We didn't check that. Okay, so now, as you said, so for the localized case, it's somehow the simplest case, but it tells you that indeed DMFT is incorporating the atomic physics into the description of the solid. And of course, in the nectites, we are in a slightly different situation, namely, we're in the metallic state, so there, we still have this description of the effective impurity of the effective atom, but now we can have Kondo screening by the bath, and we can get back to the correlated metal state, and then we have access in the theory, for example, to quasi-particle renormalizations and so on. And this is what I'm going to show you now. I will start with the, well, with the basic first version here of the 1111, which you all know, and here you all know the band structure also of the D states on the Fermi level, the P states lower down, here. And if we do our DMFT treatment on that, and what is plotted here now is the density of states of LDA in black compared with the spectral function of DMFT in red for the different iron D orbitals. Then you see what happens. Well, the generic thing is that you kind of renormalize these band features, and you do so in a slightly orbital-dependent fashion here with renormalizations for the particle weights of the order of 0.6. So we find a moderately correlated metal. So that was an early work when there was kind of a discussion out, people arguing about not insulating or band-like states. And the message from this work actually, so this is really early work still, is that if there is contradictions between DMFT calculations, you should really look how DMFT is used. Most of the time, it's actually due to the interface with the electronic structure. What Hamiltonian is treated? What are the U parameters? What are the states that are constructed? Are the P states included or not? Yes.
I see very little method of band renormalization here, right?
Well, 0.6. 0.6, yes. You take the LDA band roughly by 0.6. So it means you're not very, very strongly correlated. You're not just at the verge of a Mohr transition, but it's not described by the LDA. So, moderate.
But at the same time, the experiment we showed was showing more than phosphor 2.
No, that was the phosphor compound. So here for the arsenic, it's a little bit more tricky. Mm-hmm. And Peter, I think he was raising his hand silently.
Just curious about the broadening of the arsenic states. It looks quite asymmetric. Is that
okay? Let me show you the broadening of the arsenic states. So this is the K resolved spectral function. Mm-hmm. Here you have the arsenic states. Here you have the D states. And what you see, your question about the broadening, I think, is probably related to that. When you go away from the Fermi level, you get lifetimes getting bigger, washing out the D states. Mm-hmm. But when you come to the P, then you're well defined again because the P's are not correlated. They don't suffer from the set energy except through Hubbard relations. Is that your question?
No, I go back to your picture and I'll tell you what my question was. I'm just noticing that the DMFT pushes states downward at around minus two EV. You see that?
Okay, so you're saying this kind of tail here.
Yeah. What are the tails?
Well, I mean, you still have some kind of self-energy effects here through the hybridization, and that just smears out spectral weight.
But it smears it out asymmetrically. Is that physics? Just curious.
Okay.
Never mind.
Good question. Okay.
Question?
I haven't thought about it like that. Yes.
Clearly, you have these adjustable parameters in your theory. What protocol do you use to give values to them, and why should we believe the one you choose?
Okay, let me postpone that question because I will come to you. I will tell you.
But then why should I? These are red lines that anyone could draw.
I will tell you how we calculate you. But let me do it a few slides later because I.
But not just you, also the double counting Hamiltonian. How you?
Okay. I'm not calculating here the double counting, and we should get rid of that. We have strategies to do so, but at this stage they're in.
Right. So
at this stage I don't give you an answer, but I tell you
what. Why is the calculation with the DMFT any better than the calculation with just DMFT?
Well, the calculation.
I know we all know that we should include. You would like to include interaction effects, but if the physics is dependent on parameters, which you won't even tell me about until the end of the talk, then where do I stand?
Okay, you want me to jump ahead? Well, I wanted to show you iron selenide first, because
you can just say two sentences about it.
Okay,
is all I'd like to know. Right?
Okay, so what we do is to calculate the U from constrained RPA techniques. Mm-hmm. So actually, let me jump ahead. I will come back to the iron selenide afterwards.
I think part of the answer should be how sensitive the result is to prescription of double counting. I mean, there are maybe about three different prescriptions how to do different versions how logical is double counting. Do results strongly depend on that or not?
Okay, let me still start about with you. Okay, so what we do for the calculation of U is to use what we call the constrained random phase approximation, and that is based on the observation that U should be a partially screened quantity in the following sense. So what I want to do is I want to construct a low energy Hamiltonian, and for that low energy Hamiltonian, U should be the effective Baire interaction, right? So that means all the degrees of freedom that do not live in this low energy subspace anymore, they should be used to screen already the interaction.
This is a kind of renormalization.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a kind of poor man's version of do a RG treatment to downfall to a low energy effective Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. And the degrees of freedom that are still included in that window should not be used to screen. So now this program I can strictly do at the RPA level, where I can nicely separate which are the degrees of freedom which are included and which are not. So this is on this kind of cartoon picture demonstrated by saying that RPA is doing screening by the bubble, by particle hole excitations, so these red and yellow bubbles. And if I want, in this case, just, for example, construct a low energy Hamiltonian for that subspace, then only this yellow bubble will live in that subspace, and I will construct a partial polarization which consists of all the red particle hole transitions. So I will kind of decompose the total RPA polarization into the thing in the low energy subspace and the rest, and I will construct a Baire interaction within the subspace by screening the true Coulomb interaction, 1 over r minus r prime, only by the rest degrees of freedom. So that gives me an interaction which by construction, when screened further by the yellow bubble here, gives me the fully screened Coulomb interaction. And matrix element of this thing, this is what I call U. So that's how I
And that can give you both the Hund's and the J and the U.
Yes, this gives me U and J, and it gives me even inter-site interactions. I can even decide the question that Ivo was putting up in the other compound. It would probably be interesting to look at. What is the size of the inter-site interaction that...
Very nice.
Can I just...
Yes.
So, in the end, how well does it work in terms of, say, the mass enhancement or the optical conductivity?
Let me come there.
Of order of magnitude.
I will show you that Well, now let me make first one remark, because otherwise it gets out of order. Because, okay, I should add one thing here. Namely, this procedure gives me access not just to you as a number. There's an important issue to notice here. Namely, polarization screening depends on frequency, depends on the energy scale. I mean, we all know that. If I take an electron gas, I perturb it. The response of the electron gas depends on the frequency of that perturbation. So that means, actually, this procedure gives me a frequency-dependent interaction.
And I understand that, but the statements from the LDA plus DMFT community, which says that the initial determinations of interactions, it's very hard. So I understand you probably disagree, but I just want to take a pragmatic perspective from this calculation.
Okay. So the in a few slides, the point where I will arrive to is that, okay, it's a subtle thing, one should apply some care, but there are other approximations which I think are more severe, and when we treat that properly, we get, at least for the low energy properties, to a quantitative description. I want to convince you of that. But give me a few slides to go. Okay, so first thing, we have a frequency-dependent interaction now. However, we all believe in RNG, so we believe that low energy models should be static, so how should I understand that? Does the frequency dependence of that interaction matter? So let me look at it. Let me look at it for the volume 1 to 2.
I can picture you have a frequency dependent interaction. Is it local because this calculation you run together is only a single site calculation? DMFT?
Okay. In principle.
The cluster for the DMFT is one site.
Yes. So in principle, I can have access at local, non-local, and so on. So I can check what are the inter-site interactions. I don't believe this is in the nictite so important. We've checked it for some oxides. We know that it's important for specific, like, two-dimensional systems on surfaces. We have examples for that where it's really big. Here, I believe this is not the main error. But of course, you're right, in principle, we can plot full frequency dependence even for non-local interactions. And this frequency dependence stems from this downfolding of higher energy degrees of freedom. Yeah.
Just for clarification, I mean, there are two aspects that I think were not clearly separated in that question. One is whether you can calculate interaction parameters outside of single set approximation. The other, whether you can handle your band problem.
Yes. Okay.
Quite partial problem outside of one interaction. You just argued that in nictites, the first probably not important. The Coulomb repulsion between electrons on nictites.
And I will come to the second
but
to some extent.
The magnetic correlation between electrons may be important.
Yes. Okay.
Just a very quick question. I want to make sure I understand. So the frequency dependence won't be singular, right? Because you're essentially integrating out gapped modes. Is that
okay?
The point?
So the frequency dependence will look like this. Okay, so now you can ask the question here, this is electron volts. So we go from typical values of Hubbard interactions, 2, 3, 4 eV, to 30. That's the matrix element of 1 over r minus r prime, the bare interaction. And we do so at huge energy scales, at energy scales of 25. So does it matter? Can I just take the static value and cut off the rest or not? And probably you are prone to think the first, but I will show you that this is too quick.
And having done this crude RG, do you now impose a cutoff on your single site solver at energy scales?
No.
That, so isn't there still a double counting issue?
Yes. I will come to that.
All right.
Yes. You guys are very much too quick. Okay, so let me first show that naively taking that full frequency dependence changes things. Mm. And I will show you this on the barium 1 to 2, just the D spectral function, where I plot the LDA in blue, usual DMFT, LDA plus DMFT in red, so you have the usual normalization, and then the one with dynamic U in black. So you see from red to black, I'm losing a large amount of spectral weighting. And how can I understand that? Well, this high frequency tail, you can think of it as coupling fermions to some kind of screening bosons, plasmons, particle hole excitations, whatever. So you can think of it actually as a kind of Hubbard-Holstein model. So now you diagonalize it, you come to electronic polarons, so fermions coupled to the screening cloud of bosons. And that, of course, renormalizes the mass, renormalizing the mass means losing spectral weight, which goes to plasmon replica, and reduction in the low energy sector. So that's what we see here. Okay, before switching to where we have an additional double counting, let me point out an interesting observation from these calculations. Namely, we were looking at this barium 122 as a function of doping, just changing particle number, putting more electrons or putting holes, and we were observing an interesting behavior in the imaginary part of the self-energy on the imaginary axis. That means the quantity which should be linear at low energy if we were in a Fermi liquid. And we were finding that actually you're in a quite incoherent state at hole doping. So that would correspond to the potassium doping. At the undocked compound, things go to zero, but do so in a not linear fashion, but rather in a square root fashion. That's what we call the fractional power law here. And only when you go to the electron dope side, when you put in cobalt, so to say, you get to a more coherent picture. And that was, of course, reminiscent to what was found before in a simple free orbital Hubbard model with Hund's coupling, where Werner and Millis were arguing that in the presence of Hund coupling, you can induce a kind of spin freezing regime, a regime where local moments do not decay and you have power law behaviors of the self energy.
This has nothing to do with the band structure, with the frequency dependence of your.
No.
All these things don't really have nothing to do with this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's captured in the simplest model. Level.
Yes. the only point is maybe that I believe we see it a little bit more clearly in the frequency dependent U calculation because we have larger energy scales for you. But otherwise, you're absolutely right. It has nothing to do with dynamic screening. We were actually miscited on that point at some point. It's induced by AJ, yes. Okay, so that connects back to the observation made early on that things depend sensitively on Hund's coupling, that the effective masses are doping dependent. So here, what we say is that there's more than just the effective masses. It's really the coherence which becomes doping dependent. You can argue now that this is the MFT. We make a local approximation. One should check how this survives when you add non-local correction, so that connects back to the question before. However, you could also take the point of view that we view that local self-energy here that we construct, not so much as the local part of the physical self-energy, but as an effective quantity to represent the local Green's function. For example, in the same way as in DFT, you would construct the Kronchen potential to represent the density. So you may not want to interpret physically the Kronchen potential, but you can construct it in such a way that you get the good density. So even if you don't believe that the self-energy physically is really local, we can view this construction as giving us the spectral function. And of course, this has also consequences on the spectral function.
Doesn't the last line follow automatically from the second line on the previous slide? Let me think about that in simple single orbital GMFT. The density of states at the Fermi level is constant, which means that if I have mass normalization, that I automatically must transfer some spectral weight from Fermi level into
but here. That's special of the one band model because you have the spinning at the Fermi level. In general, you have more degrees of freedom.
Okay, that's right. But you know, wouldn't that be logical to assume that qualitatively the thing will stay the same?
Well, I think in this Hund's.
Can you explain the freezing story a little bit better? Is there a finite region in the phase diagram which is not a Fermi liquid or not? That's what.
Okay. We're not saying. Okay, let me switch here. Okay, but let me still comment on this slide before, and then I come to the next one. Because the point I wanted to make here is that if you look at the spectral function, then you see indeed the coherence or incoherence varying with doping. So this is maybe a little bit extreme cartoon-like picture. You should not necessarily take this quantitatively. But what we see is that indeed the broadness of the features varies with the doping level. Okay, so what we're saying is not that if you were cooling down, you would not recover the Fermi liquid. But at a given temperature, if I scan through the phase diagram as a function of doping, then the coherence varies.
You mean above the Fermi liquid's coherence temperature, there's another regime, which is a non-Fermi liquid, and which you can explain.
What I mean is that the coherence temperature depends strongly on the doping, yeah.
Yes.
We need to explain what is the origin of the Bauer block behavior outside the fermion.
Okay, that is the story of the Hund's coupling, which restricts the Kondo channels in the Kondo screening. So there's further works now trying to work this out in a more mathematical, systematic fashion. For example, there's a paper by Camino. But it's essentially induced by Hund's coupling, which limits the possibilities for the Kondo screening. And that is why it's becoming so filling dependent, because of course in the presence of Hund's coupling, so depending on how you fill the orbitals, you will strongly vary the.
Is there a point in the phase diagram where this fermionic temperature goes to zero, so this this frequency dependence extends to zero temperature?
No, I don't think so. But of course with Monte Carlo we have not explored that. So I think there's evidence that you still recover thermal liquid at low temperatures, but from this we cannot make a statement. Okay, then of course you can dream a little bit and ask, do experiments see something like that? And so this paper by Nakajima, and that connects back to the discussion we had yesterday, claims that if you go to the from the barium 1-2 pure compound to the cobalt doped compound, you get actually back to something more coherent, more T-square like in the resistivity, for example, and that also the optical connectivity, the Drude peak, evolves in that way. Okay, I'm just flashing that here. Okay. Let me come back to another point, because we were saying, okay, the spectral weight shifted to higher energies. So where is that going? So if I look at an inset, and here really large scale blown up, then I would expect features indeed at very huge energies. And we have been hunting around a little bit to find such things. In the paper of Hong Ding, they were claiming that they found some features by intricate resonance experiment that I cannot explain at 12 eV and at 7 eV, and at least the one here at 7 eV was found at least in two different photoemission papers from two different groups. So we believe that these kind of plasmon features are actually the spectral weight that is gone from the low energy. Okay,
and
so.
What is there any understanding of that energy scale from your calculations?
Well, yes and no. So in simple materials, we have checked that, for example, for oxides, you get a well-defined plasma scale. So as long as strontium vanadate has a typical energy scale of that thing of 15 eV, and that you can relate then back to the charged plasmon related to the charge in the p orbitals forming plasmon. Here, you have a kind of superposition of many particle hole transitions. So it's less obvious to precisely relate that to a specific transition. I think for the 70 one we have one, but for the other one it's a little bit more tricky.
But the fact that there is a coupling to plasmons and you see the photo emission that's from metals and all that, I mean that's
yeah.
The principle known.
Yes. Okay, so now, so far so nice, what's left? Let's look a little bit at the really low energy properties. And so here we've just flashed a cartoon. After long discussion with Véronique Pouet in Paris, who made photo emission experiments, we had to admit that somehow if you look at the fine details of the Fermi surface, it seems that there's additional shifts, shifting apart electron and hole pockets in the barium 1-2. You can make the same argument here on the lithium 111, where there's work from Rosa Valenti's group. And if you compare that with photo emission, you have the feeling that it does not completely account for shrinking of pockets. However, interestingly, what is QSGW here, quasi-particle self-consistent GW, many-body perturbation theory, which has non-local self-energies in a perturbative way, perturbative in the screen-Coulomb interaction, has kind of part of this effect. So now you can ask questions related to what Pierce was asking. This one particle Hamiltonian, should I really take the LDA or should I take something else? How do I avoid double counting with the screening effects that I incorporated? And okay, that's first question. Yet another question, and that becomes funny on this one here. So we took barium cobalt to arsenic 2, so the 1-2, but with D7 configuration, which is a very nice compound because according to the argument that with increasing electron doping, you get more and more coherent. Here we should have very nice photoemission features, and this is really true. The color plot is photoemission. On top is the LDA band structure in black without renormalization. So you see it's somewhat off moderately correlated matter, as expected. If we do standard LDA plus DMFT, and that's now the maximum of the spectral function here in red and black, superimposed to the photoemission, the thing looks not so bad. So the general bandwidth is more or less all right. At the Fermi surface, we have a few problems I will show you later. However, if we work harder, and now we do it with dynamical effects, we renormalize further, and we are indeed too much renormalized. So we are kind of double counting some kind of the screening. Why?
Dynamical means the CRPA effects that you use?
Yes, dynamical means DMFT with dynamical interactions, mm-hmm. with a dynamical group. So now the question is, what is going on here? Have we worked too much? Should we have stopped at the static U? Well, I think no, we have not worked enough. We have improved on the correlation part. We have improved the description of dynamical screening. But we have still been stuck with the DFT description for the one-body Hamiltonian. And for total energies in DFT, it's well known that you have cancellation effects between exchange and correlation. So if I improve on correlation, I have to improve on exchange. And what we found here is that for spectral properties, it's the same thing. If you do better on the correlation part, you have to do better also on the exchange part. So the one particle part by the dynamical U is renormalized in a way that you can even work out. So we did that in that paper here. You can directly write it in terms of a frequency-dependent U. However, now we want to also improve on the single particle part. So there's no reason to take DFT to start with as a Hamiltonian. And the argument that I will give you now is stemming from a proposal that we made a few years ago, namely to do DMFT not on top of LDA, but to do directly on top of many-body perturbation theory. That has the advantage that you can formulate it in a Green's function language, you can formulate it in a functional language, and you can get rid of the double counting, because you don't have a description of density in the one particle Hamiltonian and Green's function in the many body part. You directly work with the Green's function.
So when does an U come in the game? If you have a full many body theory, you already have Coulomb interaction, which is 1 over R
yes,
minus
yes.
1 R
so, prime. So in this theory, so I'm not saying that I will show you full GW plus DMFT calculation for the Nick guys, but in this theory, it's 1 over R minus M prime, which enters as a Coulomb interaction. And the U only comes as a self-consistent quantity in the extended DMFT sense then. So in this sense, you don't have a parameter in this theory.
This has no DFT.
This has no DFT, yes. You get rid of DFT, you get rid of U as a parameter, you directly have 1 over R minus R prime. However, of course, it's heavy to implement. We have done this only in a very simple one order term model so far.
Why do you need to add something? In GW approximation, you solve your many body problem exactly using particular class of diagrams.
Yes.
So that your point is that you include other diagrams through
yes.
the MFT part.
Yes.
That,
yes. I want to do better than GW. I want to be non-perturbative. So at GW level,
can you actually draw diagrams that you are including, or is it possible?
Yeah. No. I can show you. So I can write the free energy for the solid as a functional of the Green's function and the screen Coulomb direction. And some of the part beyond Hartree-Fock, the interesting part, is in GW approximated by GWG. So that means if you derive it with respect to G, you get the self-energy, and if you derive it with respect to W, you will get the polarization as well, right? So GW is doing this with this. Extended DMFT is doing this. It's calculating it from an impurity model.
Maybe we should show the diagrams.
Yeah, that's also really easier to understand.
Well, okay, here it's all local diagrams. There's no truncation of the perturbative theories.
Yeah, well, I guess my problem is that GW diagram are very simple, just a line and a chain of bubbles.
Yeah.
But that chain of bubbles includes also local part.
Yes,
that
yes, yes, yes.
Again, double counting.
No. Wait. So this is DMFT, extended DMFT. So now what GW plus DMFT is doing is it's taking this one as the local part. And the non-local part of that. And in that sense, you don't have another
one. In the review article, there are actually diagrams. You can show diagrams which are included in
yes. Okay. So
diagrams would be easy to understand.
So here you have all the local diagrams. Here you have the, let's say, GW diagram. But the nice thing about this is at the GW level, you can decompose things directly in local and non-local.
Yes.
And the local part of the GW diagram, as you see here, is just G impurity. So it's kind of solving the impurity model at the local level. And that provides you with the fact that it's double quantum free once you write that this is psi impurity plus psi GW non-local, where psi GW non-local is full GW minus local GW.
Your impurity itself is a subset of diagrams.
It's all local diagrams, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that means this argument tells me that in principle I should do DMFT, not on top of DFT or whatever. I should do it on top of something which is non-local GW. So now, interestingly,
but the GW also comes based on some one particle theory,
yes.
Right?
Then you can ask about self-consistency at that level. Okay, let me not get into that, but yes.
How about the exchange of the correlation energy of there is some correlation energy in the density functional theory normally. And now this GW has this is a weak coupling approximation to the correlation energy. How bad is that step? I mean, obviously you're not
For bar and cobalt, it's very nice. I will show you in a second. But let me first finish this argument. So what we should do DMFT on is something like non-local GW. So now, for example, in this paper here, it was kind of investigated what happens if you do GW and you look at local and non-local parts. And what was found is that at least at that GW level, the non-local part was dominantly static. So that means we can actually use as a starting point something like a non-local GW in a static fashion and do DMFT on top of that. So what does it mean, non-local GW? At low energies, that means screened exchange. And with that argument, we are then saying that, okay, what we want to do is to do DMFT with dynamic interactions, not on top of DFT, but on top of a screened exchange Hamiltonian. So you have, so to say, K-dependent corrections to your one-particle Hamiltonian, but these K-dependent corrections are, to good approximation, static, and that will renormalize, of course, my Fermi surfaces. So what we do now is something very simple. We do a screened Yukawa potential with the screening length determined afterwards from the spectral function of the Fermi level, and use that as a starting point to do DMFT with dynamic interactions. And what I want to argue is that that is actually pretty nice. But first, let me show you, for this case of the barium cobalt to arsenic 2, what happens. So the LDA has roughly this bandwidth, the green band. If I go to GW, I narrow the band because I have exchange and then correlations narrowing it. If I do screened exchange, then I'm only widening the band. So now what I do, I go from LDA to the screened exchange thing, but I don't add the correlation part of GW. I add the correlation part from DMFT with dynamical U, and that gives me the additional band renormalization that I've seen before. So now we do that for the barium cobalt. This is the spectral function, and this is the comparison with experiment. So we are really nicely back to the photoemission spectrum. However, what is more, we have not only reproduced the LDA plus DMFT starting bandwidth, but we have also improved things at the Fermi level, because if now we zoom in, and this is screen exchange plus DMFT, this is DFT plus DMFT, then you see that at the Fermi level here, the LDA plus DMFT was actually not so great. We had kind of crossings here, this band here, and the real things were here, and actually the density of states must be much lower than LDA or LDA plus DMFT indicate, because otherwise you would be stoner ferromagnetic. In the screen exchange plus DMFT, you have corrected that deficiency.
But you've completely lost one of the bands.
We have a problem somewhere here that we are a little bit too low, but we believe that this is due to two things. First thing, there's an argument that in this region there could be some spin orbit. We did GW calculation with and without spin orbit, and there's some issue about that, so we're not completely sure what it is due to. And the other thing is, we're also doing it in a relatively crude fashion, because we're replacing the full W just by this screening cover, and that could have some influence there also. But on the Fermi level, I think the improvement is really quite convincing.
So all the questions that we heard so far is about where the bands are, and how, you know, different terms can move these bands back and forth. This is the real part of the self-energy, it gives transfer spectral wave and moving bands. But I think, to me, the biggest advantage of this DMFT calculation is that you can calculate inelastic scattering rate, which is not directly related to moving the bands, but it is important for transport kinetic properties.
Could
you comment on, how good our various approaches was based entirely on the real part. How good is the real part of such an energy? You can comment how much it affects the scattering rate, which is already a bigger bonus.
Yes.
It's certainly density function theory cannot do that at all.
You're absolutely right, and we are starting to look into that, but okay, so that's too fresh, I will not comment on that. And even the shifting of the bands, I think it's nice, because if you have a Green's function which doesn't have the right Fermi surface, afterwards what do you do? Okay. So getting the right Fermi surface, I think, was first kind of interesting step. Okay, let me finish on a funny remark, because if we go now back from the nictites, one other commercial slide, we go to an uncorrelated material. We still have the effect of the screen exchange widening the band. And
Schrödinger band is not necessarily uncorrelated. Still has transition metals.
Yes, okay. But so here, this is transient titanate 8 with slight electron doping. And what we found is that actually you can describe it. So I'm not entering in superconductivity, I'm not entering in polarons, I'm not entering in the real interesting physics here. But what I want to argue is that you can demonstrate in this example that the screen exchange broadening and the dynamical renormalization, because the high frequency tail of U remains, cancel largely to end up with a band structure which resembles, in that case, the DFT band structure. And that is what GW would also give you, because you just shift the band structure in a scissor-like fashion. So I think this opens interesting perspectives on how to connect back to usual concept Shem theory in the case of weakly interacting systems. Okay, let me flash my conclusions in a pictorial way here. So I've shown you, well actually I've not shown you the iron selenate Hubbard band, but I can go back there if there's questions on me to do that. I've shown you the nictite, how to color your car. We have discussed about the barium 1-2 and the doping dependence. And I've shown you that we are quite happy now with a low energy description based on screened exchange plus DMFT, meaning that we get rid of the LDA, we have non-local exchange beyond the LDA, and we have dynamic screening beyond the usual DMFT. And before really ending, just as an appetizer, anybody interested in the kind of systems Igor was presenting in the sense of non-local interactions, so we are also working on that. And that connects back to Vlad's question also, how to treat non-local interactions effectively, backfolding then into an effective local interaction, which then becomes frequency dependent with the extended DMFT like this. So if you're interested in that, please grab me over coffee or lunch or whatever. Thank you very much for your attention. Yes, Peter.
So this is a little bit related to Igor's question. You said that the direct connection between the quasi-particle renormalization and the effective mass and the incoherence was not direct if you had a multi-band model.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
But the story that I think we've heard a few times in this workshop is that as you approach the sort of Mott transition, you get this Mott selectivity, and the XY orbital acquires both. It becomes incoherent and acquires a large mass in these nictite systems. So question number one, is it simply that the XY orbital is dominating everything as you approach that transition, and therefore it becomes more your calculations reduce that effect?
Wait, okay. I would precisely interpret that statement as an example showing you that it's not just at that quasi-particle residue you necessarily have that lifetime, because things become orbital dependent and become in a fashion that depends on the crystal fields, the J, and so on.
But the XY, for example, is becoming much smaller, the Z is much smaller, and the spectral function is much broader. So that's happening in parallel.
Yes, but I thought the question was, can we make a map somehow? If we have that Z, we have that lifetime, right?
I think Peter is asking how much of the mass enhancement differs between the XY orbitals and the other orbitals in your calculation. Is that one way to characterize your
question? Yeah.
You sort of promised to come back to the low energy, the mass enhancement, and optical conductivity suppression. What sort of overall characterization of your conclusion?
So we were looking into this mass differentiation. We see it actually in specific doping regimes, but we don't see it generally.
As a whole?
Yes, but only at specific domains. So we are still looking into that.
My understanding was that this is, there is like a general trend, which other people were also talking about, that as you hold up, you go closer to hub doping regime. You get more and more correlated consistently. Not that some specific domain when something happens, but just as you go away from hub doping, you get less correlated, you go closer to hub doping,
that's more. Yes and no. I mean, there's two things. There's this general picture. Overall, this is what we see. Close to the D5, you get more incoherence. So this is the D6 hold load. And if you go to larger electron doping, you get more coherent. However, the question, if this is happening in an orbital selective way, that I think depends a little bit more on the compound and the regime.
You get some magic number.
Yes, and most of the systematic studies, so if you think of the work of Luca, if you look at it in slate boson pictures at zero temperatures, you don't have access to this coherence. You see the variation of the Z very systematically, but you don't have the effect of the P states, you don't have the final temperature thing, you don't have coherence properties. So I think.
If I think what you are saying would be in play, you will see even in Z, you will see some sort of non monotonic behavior, this non smooth behavior. Whenever you.
The question is, does the Z still exist?
In the Lucas calculation, you would probably think that when you reach hub doping for one particular orbital for XY, you would have some sort of, increase, temporal increase of incoherency. When you dope further, you go farther away. So it's some intermediate doping between half and between 5 and 6, you hit a point where your most important orbital becomes half doped. And you would see that in anything that you're plotting against doping.
Yes and no, but still, the question in the first place is Z well defined? So I'm at a finite temperature, and the question of having incoherence here means in the first place that Z becomes less well defined and at the end doesn't exist anymore.
So maybe a related question will clarify. In a single band Hubbard model, we got the general Kunzel coupling. We have to get close to the Martin insulator to find the small Z and large incoherence. But apparently here, there's a much broader, regime because of Kunzel coupling where these correlation effects are much more pronounced. So can you comment on that? Why, is there a simple way to understand this in words? Why that happens in this multi-orbital case?
I mean, I think for this area, I point you back to the work of Luca. I mean, in the model context, 5-orbital, to see how the Z goes down, but still not going to zero. This is what they argue about this dichotomy effect of the Unschuld scrapping concerning the gap and concerning the counter channel. So there's this very nice paper. I'm not the right person to give the story on that. I think this is, in the model context, this is quite well answered.
But it's related to the question of your square root of omega. And so, is it true that in this entire regime where this is, you have these large masses in one of the orbitals, then you find this anomalous incoherent transport or things like this? Is this really true?
Sorry, can you repeat?
This entire regime, which is not very broad, where you have this large Z, a small Z, and so is there a really broad range of temperatures and dopings where we see this non-thermalytic behavior?
Yes. But the second question is, do I see it in an orbital selective way? And that's not necessarily.
It's not necessarily.
Yeah. Because the Wundt's rule effect in the five orbital model is there, even if you look at degenerate bands, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second question is this effect becoming orbital dependent or not?
I see. Good point.
So we have the first one largely, but the second one we need to look more.
Just to follow up on this point directly. There's quite a bit of experiment by the Stanford group on the various kind of Kalpogi nights,
yes,
in which the mass enhancement between the different orbitals is humongous. You know, XY orbital mass enhancement gets to as large as 20 and so on and so forth. So it might be, in some sense, one can turn around to sort of, as a check of the method you are recently developing and ask question if in those cases, it's actually n is still close to 6, but it's just different.
Yes.
Whether you get this strong optical dependence or not.
The 20 was on iron, selenium, tellurium, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
From Arcus. And I think there is an important caveat to make, because just looking at the Arcus spectral function and rescaling the LDA does not give you the mass enhancement. And the reason is that you have shifts between different orbitals. So if you just plot the LDA band structure and try the best factor to fit the orbis, you can get 20. But we get essentially analogous spectral functions with a factor of 5 and a shift before, which is encoded in the real part of the self-energy at zero frequency.
Yeah, I mean, there's a more elaborate analysis by Ming Yi, which was talked about at a conference during this program.
Okay.
And the point is that both the analysis of mass enhancement and the temperature dependence of the evolution of the XY spectral weight,
mm-hmm.
they provide a consistent picture. And
for iron telluride?
Well, for several, including iron telluride, okay. 70, 50 or so.
Okay,
also for calcium iron selenide. So I think that there's some settings where you don't have to go to n very far away from 6,
mm-hmm.
and yet one can already check this issue, partly as also a check of your methodology.
Okay. Well, we can discuss
that.
I don't know
that. So can I kind of paraphrase the methodology part of what you've done by saying, in essence, it's a kind of reproduction in the correlation version of what happened in density functional theory with the band gap of silicon, that you're kind of treating the cone sham electrons in LDA with much more seriousness than you should. And GW was kind of invented to get rid of the factor of 2 error in the band gap of silicon.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, what you've done here is said, well, when I go to dynamical mean field theory plus information from density functional theory, I need something which doesn't give too much emphasis to the original cone sham electrons. Why should I treat those fictitious things as being anything to do with the real band structure?
I fully followed your argument, but indeed the reasoning is there's no reason a priori to start from DFT Hamiltonian.
It's whether the cone sham electrons are real.
Can be wrong.
I think that's a correct statement, right? I mean, you're getting further away from cone sham.
Actually,
I was interested in this iron selenide Hubbard band, but I mean, maybe we can do that in a second.
Let me switch back, because I think it's nice to show very quickly why we were saying that there's a Hubbard band. Okay, so the analysis for iron selenide gave us the spectral function here again compared to the LDA, black LDA in red, the DMFT part. And okay, what you have here without surprise, the P states. The D states from the LDA are renormalized to this thing actually, and we have an additional peak here. The reason why we say this is an additional thing and not just kind of washed out band states is that when now we crank up U artificially, this thing moves outward, whereas this becomes more normalized. And that tells you that it cannot be just a band state. So that's actually the inside the position of our band moving outside. Okay, then we went to the photo emission and we found that there was a paper actually already out where Yoshida and I, where people were arguing that there is a feature which they, due to resonance experiments, photon energy dependence, were arguing should be of D character, and which we were then asking, is that really the Howard band that we are looking at? And people were kind of confirming that the afterwards Japanese group, they also were claiming that they saw that feature. So now what Bern is saying that within the orbits, we can even track the dispersion of that thing. So I haven't put his picture because
that's... But in the calculation, is there some temperature-induced transfer of spectral weight between this part of the states and the low-energy states?
Okay, we didn't do very careful temperature-dependent calculation on that.
Might be instructive.
Yeah. But it's heavy. I mean, we are redoing calculations on this now with the screen exchange, so then we can see.
So let me, if you allow me, this is a very important question was raised. Why should we trust conserved particles at all?